One of the most extensive recorded discussions of impeachment occurred at the North Carolina Ratification Convention in remarks made by James Iredell. Iredell, who later served as a justice of the Supreme Court, spoke of the supremacy of the law under the system of government proposed by the Constitution. He said, "No man has an authority to injure another with impunity. No citizen is better than his fellow citizens, nor can pretend to any superiority over the meanest man in the country. If the president does a single act by which the people are prejudiced, he is punishable himself. If he commits any misdemeanor in office, he is impeachable." Iredell also expressed the view that impeachment may be used only in cases where there is some corrupt motive. He said, "When any man is impeached, it must be for an error of the heart and not of the head. Whatever mistake a man may make, he ought not to be punished for it, nor his posterity rendered infamous. But if a man be a villain and willfully abuse his trust, he is to be held up as a public offender and ignominiously punished. According to these principles, I suppose the only instances in which the president would be liable to impeachment would be where he had received a bribe or acted from some corrupt motive or other." Iredell's comments buttress the view that impeachment is not to be used as a political weapon to resolve differences of policy between the legislative branch and the executive branch. Impeachment is not an appropriate remedy for errors, even serious errors, in the administration of government. To justify impeachment, there must be some corrupt motive, a willful abuse of trust, an error of the heart. You will note that there is nothing in Iredell's comments to suggest that a president who is engaged in a corrupt course of conduct by obstructing justice and committing perjury would be immune from impeachment and removal. Another major discussion during the debate over ratification occurs in the Federalist Number 65, to which reference has already been made in these proceedings, where Alexander Hamilton describes the impeachment process as a method of national inquest into the conduct of public men, and discusses the power of the Senate in their judicial character as a court for the trial of impeachments. Now, before I discuss his views on impeachment, I would like to say a word in defense of Alexander Hamilton, who is a widely acknowledged champion of our Constitution, widely acknowledged as one of the most eloquent expositors and defenders of the Constitution. Unfortunately, the reputation of Alexander Hamilton has in recent days been traduced. It is unjust to the memory of this great man to compare his personal sins with the crimes of President Clinton. When Hamilton was questioned about his affair, he told the truth. He took responsibility for his conduct. There is no evidence that he ever engaged in acts of corruption. He never lied under oath. He never obstructed justice. And notwithstanding the efforts of his lawyers, President Clinton by no means benefits from a comparison with Alexander Hamilton. In The Federalist, Hamilton writes of the Senate, "The subjects of its jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may with peculiar propriety be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself." Hamilton recognized that the focus of the impeachment power is on the misconduct of public men or the abuse or violation of some public trust. Impeachment is a remedy against officials for injuries done to the society itself. Despite the claims of the president's lawyers, the comments of Hamilton do not support the view that a president can be impeached and removed only for an abuse of power. The misconduct of public men and the abuse or violation of some public trust to which Hamilton refers are not restricted to offenses involving the misuse of official power. The misconduct of public men encompasses a whole range of wrongful deeds committed by those who hold office when those offenses are committed. The public trust is violated whenever a public officer breaches any duty he has to the public. Injuries done to the society itself similarly may occur as a result of misconduct that does not involve the misuse of the powers of office. Now, I would submit to the Senate that the English precedents, the records of the Constitutional Convention debates, and the general principles set forth by Hamilton, Iredell, and others in the debate over ratification do not provide a definitive list of high crimes and misdemeanors, but they do provide broad guidance concerning the scope of the impeachment power. The theme running through all these background sources is that the impeachment process is designed to provide a remedy for the corrupt and lawless acts of public officials. Not surprisingly, those who have been on the receiving end of impeachment proceedings have been quick to argue for a restrictive meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors. President Clinton's lawyers follow in that well-established tradition. They attempt to minimize the significance of charges of perjury and obstruction of justice against the president. In essence, they argue that treason and bribery are the prototypical high crimes and misdemeanors, and the crimes charged against the president are insufficiently similar in both their nature and seriousness to treason and bribery. But as the comments of my fellow manager, Mr. Boyer, have made clear, the crimes set forth in the articles of impeachment are indeed serious offenses against our system of justice. They were certainly viewed as serious offenses by those who drafted and ratified the Constitution. As Mr. Boyer has mentioned in his discussion of offenses against the public justice, Sir William Blackstone, whose work James Madison said was in every man's hand during the creation of the Constitution, listed the offenses of perjury and bribery side by side, immediately after he listed treason. 1790, the first Congress adopted, as you have already heard, a statute entitled An Act for the Punishment of Certain Crimes Against the United States, making perjury a crime punishable as a felony. Nothing could be clearer. Perjury is a crime against the United States. It is not a private matter. As Mr. Chabot noted yesterday, John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the United States, said that there is no crime more extensively pernicious to society than perjury. According to Jay, perjury discolors and poisons the streams of justice, and by substituting falsehood for truth, saps the foundations of personal and public rights. He said, if oaths should cease to be held sacred, our dearest and most valuable rights would become insecure. Given this understanding that was current at the time the Constitution was adopted, it is impossible to support the conclusion that perjury and the related offense of obstruction of justice are somehow trivial offenses that do not rise to the same level as the offense of bribery, which is enumerated in the Constitution. Moreover, perjury and obstruction of justice are by their very nature akin to bribery. When the crime of bribery is committed, money is given and received to corruptly alter the course of official action. When justice is obstructed, action is undertaken to corruptly thwart the due administration of justice. When perjury occurs, false testimony is given under oath in order to deceive judges and juries and to prevent the just determination of causes pending in the courts. The fundamental purpose and the fundamental effect of each of these offenses, perjury, obstruction of justice, and bribery alike, is to defeat the proper administration of government. They are all crimes of corruption aimed at substituting private advantage for the public interest. They all undermine the integrity of the functions of government. The use of the impeachment process against misconduct, which undermines the integrity of government, is a central focus of two reports prepared in 1974 on the background and history of impeachment. And I would humbly bring these reports to your attention. I commend them to you for your consideration. One of the reports was prepared by the staff of the Nixon impeachment inquiry. The other was produced by the Bar of the City of New York. Both of these reports have gained bipartisan respect over the last 25 years for their balanced and judicious approach. They provide a well-informed analysis of the key issues related to impeachments. In doing so, they stand in stark contrast to the recent pronouncements by some academics which substitute political opinion for scholarly analysis. A review of these two documents from 1974 supports the conclusion that the articles before the Senate set forth compelling grounds for the conviction and removal of President Clinton. Now, there has been a great deal of comment on the report on constitutional grounds for presidential impeachment prepared in February of 1974 by the staff of the Nixon impeachment inquiry. Those who assert that the charges against the president do not rise to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors have pulled some phrases from that report out of context to support their position. In fact, the general principles concerning grounds for impeachment and removal set forth in that report indicate that perjury and obstruction of justice are high crimes and misdemeanors. Consider this key language from the staff report describing the type of conduct which gives rise to the proper use of the impeachment and removal power. In the report, they said, the emphasis has been on the significant effects of the conduct, undermining the integrity of office, disregard of constitutional duties and oath of office, arrogation of power, abuse of the governmental process, adverse impact on the system of government. The report goes on to state, because impeachment of a president is a grave step for the nation, it is to be predicated only upon conduct seriously incompatible with either the constitutional form and principles of our government or the proper performance of constitutional duties of the presidential office. Perjury and obstruction of justice, I would submit to you, clearly undermine the integrity of office. I ask you, if these offenses do not undermine the integrity of office, what offenses would? Their unavoidable consequence is to erode respect for the office of the president and to interfere with the integrity of the administration of justice. Such offenses are seriously incompatible with the president's constitutional duties and oath of office and with the principles of our government establishing the rule of law. Moreover, they are offenses which have a direct and serious adverse impact on the system of government. Obstruction of justice is, by definition, an assault on the due administration of justice, which is a core function of our system of government. Perjury has the same purpose and effect. The second report to which I have referred, the thoughtful report on the law of presidential impeachment prepared by the Association of the Bar of the City of New York, in January of 1974, also places a great deal of emphasis on the corrosive impact of presidential misconduct on the integrity of government. The report summarizes the proper basis for impeachment and removal in this way. It says, it is our conclusion in summary that the grounds for impeachment are not limited to or synonymous with crimes. Rather, we believe that acts which undermine the integrity of government are appropriate grounds whether or not they happen to constitute offenses under the general criminal law. In our view, the essential nexus to damaging the integrity of government may be found in acts which constitute corruption in or flagrant abuse of the powers of official position. It may also be found in acts which, without directly affecting governmental processes, undermine that degree of public confidence in the probity of executive and judicial officers that is essential to the effectiveness of government in a free society. Perjury and obstruction of justice, serious felony offenses against the United States by a president, are acts of corruption which without doubt undermine that degree of public confidence in the probity of the president that is essential to the effectiveness of government in a free society. Such acts are high crimes and misdemeanors because they inevitably subvert the respect for law, which is essential to the well-being of our constitutional system. A similar point is made by a contemporary commentator who has argued, and I quote, "There are certain statutory crimes that, if committed by public officials, reflect such lapses of judgment, such disregard for the welfare of the state, and such lack of respect for the law and the office held by the occupants, that the occupants may be impeached and removed for lacking the minimal level of integrity and judgment sufficient to discharge the responsibilities of office." Such a lack of the minimal level of integrity necessary for the proper discharge of the duties of the presidency is evidenced by the commission of the statutory crimes of perjury and obstruction of justice. Contrary to the claim that has been made by some, the issue before the Senate is not whether the offenses of this president will destroy our Constitution. We all know that our system of government will not come tumbling down because of the corrupt conduct of William Jefferson Clinton. Our republic will survive the crimes of this president. No one doubts that. Of course, the same could be said of all the other federal officials who have been impeached and removed from office. And the same might be said of the crimes, serious as they were, of President Richard Nixon. But the removal power is not restricted to offenses that would directly destroy our Constitution or system of government. The removal power is not so limited that it can be brought into play only when the immediate destruction of our institutions is threatened. On the contrary, the removal power should be understood as a positive grant of authority to the Senate to preserve, protect, and strengthen our constitutional system against the misconduct of federal officials when that misconduct would subvert, undermine, or weaken the institutions of our government. It is a power that has the positive purpose of maintaining the health and well-being of our system of government. This power, the awesome power of removal vested in the Senate, carries with it an awesome responsibility. This power imposes on the Senate the responsibility to exercise its judgment in establishing the standards of conduct that are necessary to preserve, protect, and strengthen the Constitution, which has served the people of the United States so well for more than two centuries. Thus, the crucial issue before the Senate is what standard will be set for the conduct of the President of the United States. In this case, the Senate necessarily will establish such a standard. And make no mistake about it, the choice the Senate makes in this case will have consequences reverberating far into the future of our republic. Will a president who has committed serious offenses against the system of justice be called to account for his crimes, or will his offenses be regarded as of no constitutional consequence? Will a standard be established that such crimes by a president will not be tolerated, or will the standard be that, at least in some cases, a president may remain in office with all his infamy after lying under oath and obstructing justice? Regardless of the choice the Senate makes, whether it acquits or convicts the president, a standard will be established, and that standard will become an important part of the constitutional law of this nation. The institutions of our government will either be strengthened or weakened as a result. And if the Senate acquits this president, the conduct of future presidents will inevitably be affected in ways that we cannot now confidently predict. I would now like to take a very few minutes to examine some of the other specific arguments that have been made that it is not now a proper case before the Senate for the use of the removal power. Some have suggested that in setting a standard in this case, the Senate should be guided by the popularity of the president. It is urged that a popular president, regardless of the offenses he may have committed, should not be removed from office. Such a view finds no support, however, in our Constitution. On the contrary, the framers understood that a popular president might be guilty of crimes requiring his removal from office. That's why they included the power of impeachment removal in the Constitution. And that is no doubt why they specifically provided that an impeached official who was convicted and removed might also be perpetually disqualified any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. The potential threat posed to our institutions by presidential misconduct would in fact be heightened by the popularity of the offending president. The harmful influence and example of a popular president would pose a far greater danger to the well-being of our government than the influence and example of an unpopular president. Moreover, the very framework of our Constitution establishing a representative democracy is at odds with the notion that the institutions of our government should respond mechanically to the changing tides of public opinion. The Senate, in particular, was designed to act on the basis of the long-term best interests of the nation rather than short-term political considerations. When he was tried by the Senate 130 years ago, President Andrew Johnson was overwhelmingly unpopular. If the Senate had used presidential popularity as a guide in the Johnson case, there is no doubt that he would have been convicted and removed from office. Yet today there is widespread agreement that such action by the Senate would have been an abuse of the constitutional process. And those who refuse to use presidential popularity as their guide are hailed as great statesmen and heroes. Those senators who then stood against the tide of public sentiment today are revered as champions of constitutional government. A popular president guilty of high crimes and misdemeanors should no more remain in office than an unpopular president innocent of wrongdoing should be removed from office. Under the standards of the Constitution, popularity is not a sufficient guide. Nor should the Senate be swayed by the claims that setting a standard adverse to this president will weaken the institution of the presidency. Describing the role of impeachment under our Constitution, Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr., who I will candidly admit takes a different view of the matter today, wisely observed, "The genius of impeachment lay in the fact that it could punish the man without punishing the office. For in the presidency as elsewhere, power was ambiguous. The power to do good meant also the power to do harm. The power to serve the republic, also the power to demean and defile it." Rather than weakening the presidency, the removal from office of a president who has violated his constitutional duty and oath of office will reestablish the integrity of the presidency. Setting a standard against the acts of perjury and obstruction of justice committed by President Clinton will reaffirm the dignity and the honor of the office of chief executive under our Constitution. That will strengthen, not weaken, the institution of the presidency. It has even been argued that the impeachment and removal of President Clinton would result in the virtual alteration of our system of government. It is contended that following the constitutional process in this case would move us toward a transformation of our Constitution, a quasi-parliamentary system with the president serving at the pleasure of the legislative branch would replace the framework based on the separation of powers. I am frankly reluctant to dignify this argument by responding to it. President Nixon was driven from office for his crimes under threat of impeachment and removal. The disruption of the framework of our government did not ensue. President Clinton may be removed from office for his crimes. The constitutional system will remain sound. Who has so little confidence in the durability of the institutions of our government that he would allow a president guilty of perjury and obstruction of justice to remain in office simply on the basis of a fanciful and irrational fear of the supposed consequences of his removal? The Constitution contains wise safeguards against the misuse of the impeachment and removal power. As a practical matter, As we all know, the requirement of a two-thirds vote for conviction virtually ensures that the president will only be removed when a compelling case for removal has been made. And the periodic accountability to the people of members of both the House and Senate serves as a check on the improvident use of the impeachment power for unworthy or insubstantial reasons. Those who would abuse the power of impeachment and removal will be deterred by the certain knowledge that they ultimately must answer to the people. But of course, the ultimate safeguard against the abuse of this power is in the sober deliberation and sound judgment of the Senate itself. The framers of the Constitution vested the removal power and responsibility in the Senate because, as Hamilton observed, they thought the Senate the most fit depository of this important trust. The Senate was, in the view of the framers, uniquely qualified to exercise the awful discretion which a court of impeachment must necessarily have. As Hamilton explained, where else than in the Senate could have been found a tribunal sufficiently dignified or sufficiently independent? What other body would be likely to feel confidence enough in his own situation to preserve unawed and uninfluenced the necessary impartiality between an individual accused and the representatives of the people, his accusers? Ladies and gentlemen of the Senate, this is the great trust which the Constitution has reposed in you. It is a trust you exercise not only for those who elected you, but for all other Americans, including generations yet unborn. As you carry out this trust, we do not suggest that you hold this president or any president to a standard of perfection. We do not assert that this president or any president be called to account before the Senate for his personal failings or his sins. We will leave the president's sins to his family and to God. Nor do we suggest that this president or any president should be removed from office for offenses that are not serious and grave. But we do submit that when this president or any president has committed serious offenses against the system of justice, offenses involving the stubborn and calculated choice to place personal interest ahead of the public interest, he must not be allowed to act with impunity. Mr. Manager Graham has reviewed the recent precedents of the Senate establishing that offenses such as those committed by this president are grounds for removal from office. Those precedents, which were set in the impeachment trials of federal judges, are rejected as totally irrelevant by the president's lawyers. They urge that a lower standard of integrity be established in this case for the president of the United States than the standard which the Senate has already established for federal judges. But the Constitution contains a single standard for the exercise of the impeachment and removal power. You've heard it before, but I will repeat. Article 2, Section 4 provides, the President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And there is nothing in the Constitution suggesting that criminal offenses which constitute high crimes and misdemeanors, if committed by one federal official, will not be high crimes and misdemeanors if committed by another federal official. There is nothing in the Constitution to suggest that the president should be especially insulated from the just consequences of his criminal conduct. Justice Joseph Story warned long ago against countenancing so absolute a despotism of opinion and practice, which might make that a crime at one time or in one person, which would be deemed innocent at another time or in another person. The Senate should heed the warning of Justice Story and refuse to arbitrarily establish a different standard for judging William Jefferson Clinton than the standard it has imposed already on others brought before the bar of the Senate, sitting as a court of impeachment. The Senate has never accepted the view that a separate standard applies to the impeachment and removal of federal judges. Indeed, the Senate has specifically rejected attempts to establish such a separate standard for judicial officers. Every judge who has been impeached and removed from office.
This is WKAR East Lansing, Michigan State University Radio.
Today's programming on WKAR is made possible in part by a contribution from Jeremy Freed and Kathleen Tully in celebration of their fifth wedding anniversary.
Any authority to remove a judge for misconduct other than for those offenses involving treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. Rather than establishing a standard for removal, the Good Behavior Clause simply provides for life tenure for all Article III judges. To accept the Good Behavior Clause, I would caution you to accept it as a separate basis for the removal of federal judges would pose a serious threat to the independence of the judiciary under our Constitution. Members of the Senate, the integrity of the administration of justice depends not only on the integrity of justice, of judges, but also on the integrity of the president. A president who has committed perjury and obstruction of justice is hardly fit to oversee the enforcement of the laws of the United States. As Professor Jonathan Turley has pointed out, and I quote, as chief executive, the president stands as the ultimate authority over the Justice Department and the administration's enforcement policies. It is unclear how prosecutors can legitimately threaten, let alone prosecute, citizens who have committed perjury or obstruction of justice under circumstances virtually identical to the president's. Such inherent conflict will be even greater in the military cases and the president's role as commander-in-chief. It would indeed be anomalous for the Senate to now hold the President of the United States to a lower standard of integrity than the standard applied to members of the judiciary. There is no sensible constitutional rationale for such a lower standard. Who could successfully defend the view that in the framework established by our Constitution, the integrity of the chief executive is of less importance than the integrity of any one of the hundreds of federal judicial officers? It is the president who appoints justices of the Supreme Court and all other federal judges. It is the president who appoints the attorney general. It is the president who appoints the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It is the president who has the unreviewable power to grant pardons. The power of the president under our Constitution far surpasses the power of any other individual under our Constitution. The authority and discretion vested in him under the Constitution and laws is great and wide-ranging. The requirement that he act with integrity and that he be a person of integrity is essential to the integrity of our system of government. Soon after the adoption of the Constitution, Alexander Hamilton wrote that an inviolable respect for the Constitution and laws is the most sacred duty and the greatest source of security in a republic. Hamilton understood that respect for the Constitution itself grows out of a general respect for the law. And he understood the essential connection between respect for law and the maintenance of liberty in a republic. Without respect for the law, the foundation of our Constitution is not secure. Without respect for the law, our freedom is at risk. Thus, according to Hamilton, those who set examples which undermine or subvert the authority of the laws lead us from freedom to slavery. Early in our own century, century which is soon coming to its end, Justice Brandeis spoke of the harm to our system of government which occurs when officials of the government act in a lawless manner. Justice Brandeis said, decency, security, and liberty alike demand that government officials shall be subjected to the same rules of conduct that are commands to the citizens. In a government of laws, existence of the government will be imperiled if it fails to observe the law scrupulously. Our government is the potent, the omnipresent teacher. For good or ill, It teaches the whole people by its example. Crime is contagious. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. To conclude, I would observe that in the case before it now, the Senate must decide if William Jefferson Clinton, as president, will be subjected to the same rules of conduct that are commands to the citizens. Times for which other citizens are adjudicated felons and sent to prison? Or will this Senate, acting in accordance with the provisions of the Constitution, bring him as president into submission to the commands of the law? Will the Senate give force to the constitutional provision for impeachment and removal, which Justice Story said compels the chief magistrate as well as the humblest citizen to bend to the majesty of the laws? For good or for ill, William Jefferson Clinton teaches the whole people by his example as president. That is an undeniable fact. The president is not only the head of government, but also the head of state. As president, he has a unique ability to command the attention of the whole nation. In his words and his deeds, he represents the American people and our system of government in a way that no other American can. Great honor and respect accrue to him by virtue of the high office he holds. The influence of his example is far-reaching and profound. By his conduct, President William Jefferson Clinton has set an example this Senate cannot ignore. By his example, he has set a dangerous and subversive standard of conduct. His calculated and stubbornly persistent misconduct while serving as President of the United States has set a pernicious example of lawlessness, an example which by its very nature subverts respect for the law. His perverse example has the inevitable effect of undermining the integrity of both the office of President and the administration of justice. Ladies and gentlemen of the Senate, I humbly submit to you that this harmful example as president must not stand. The maintenance and office of a president guilty of perjury and obstruction of justice is inconsistent with the maintenance of the rule of law. In light of the historic purpose of impeachment, the offenses charged against the president demand that the Senate convict and remove him. He must not remain in office with all his infamy. Our Constitution requires that this president, who has shown such disrespect for the truth, such disrespect for the law, and such disrespect for the dignity of his high office, be brought to justice for his high crimes and misdemeanors. Thank you.
The chair recognizes the majority leader.
Mr. Chief Justice, if there's no objection, I ask the Court of Impeachment stand in adjournment for 1 hour. We will return at 10 minutes after 2.
In the absence of objection, it's so ordered.
News. The United States Senate is back in session as a court of impeachment, listening to House Manager George Gekas, a Republican from Pennsylvania.
That moment of truth will swoop down on you at some point in the near future, at which time the millions of words that have been spoken thus far, the thousands of pages of documents and the hundreds of exhibits and the dozens of individuals that have been involved in the preparation and the annotation and the accumulation of all the data and evidence, all of that will be funneled into that last moment that you will have right before you cast that final vote. And that's an awesome moment in the history of this chamber and in the personal history of your own careers in public service and of your own life as well, your personal life, your surroundings, your family, all that means anything and everything to you. That moment of truth encompasses all of that in one fell swoop at that final time that is upon us. And we would not have even had to contemplate, nor you would have had to, if very early on in the factual situation that arose in this case, if early on President Clinton had faced his moment of truth. As I pointed out yesterday, that first moment of truth that faced the president in the legal proceedings that were to engulf him at a later point was his answers, the answers that he affixed to that first set of interrogatories under oath. The moment of truth was staring him right in the face. And if he would have acknowledged it, that moment, had paid faith and allegiance to that moment, we would not be arguing here today, nor would we have even heard of a possible impeachment inquiry. But the president chose to sweep away that moment of truth, which was at hand, and proceeded down that course which has led us to this moment. In the words of our colleagues who made magnificent presentations of the facts and laws to you, the words truth and fairness were some of the strongest and most profound that we heard in various degrees and touching upon various subjects that were important to our presentation. And when I heard my colleagues emphasize those words, it dawned on me that that element of fairness is something which I submit to you and certify to you that these managers and members of the committee who prepared this case exulted in making certain would apply to their endeavors and to all that we would present to you, fairness. When the record of the independent counsel, the referral, reached our doorsteps back in September of 97, and we first read the details and the allegations that were contained therein, we did not, as some people began to accuse and to orate, adopt 100% everything that the independent counsel said were the allegations and accept them as fact and then move on to that, to skip from September to this moment, not having used our intellect, our sympathies, our sense of right, our sense of wrong, our sense of fairness, our elements of truth, our experience, our own intellect, our own conscience. We didn't set all of those aside and take the referral of Kenneth Starr and make that the final moment that precedes your moment of truth. Everyone should know that, but it's not recognized. We have been pilloried many times over the course of these proceedings on the notion that we simply adopted that referral and walked with it into the Senate chambers. One thing that has to be said right at the outset, when I saw in those allegations of the independent counsel, one that was encompassed around the question of executive privilege, in which the allegation was that the assertion by the president, by President Clinton, of executive privilege in the context of all that has transpired in this case, that that constituted in that allegation by Judge Starr an abuse of power, I must tell you that that hit me right between the eyes. I could not, by even reading it, just reading it, accept it at face value. And from that moment until this, I had serious, grave doubts that we should embark upon a course in which we would somehow denigrate the issue and the privilege known as the executive privilege. As I worried about this and as I moved on through the process trying to do my duty along with everyone else, there came a time in the deliberations of our committee, of our managers group, that we felt, and we acted on that feeling, that executive privilege is something that is owed to President Clinton, that we cannot fairly strip that away from him or in any way diminish the power and the usability of executive privilege. We felt that that was a trapping and a power of the executive, of the President of the United States, which, no matter how it's exerted or thereafter possibly set aside by the court, which is always a possibility, and history has shown that that has occurred, nevertheless, the exertion of it, the assertion of it, the use of it, the feel for it that the President of the United States must have and should have, in the first instance, to assert it, should not be a part of our criticism, our projection of this case. We felt pretty strongly about it, and we took action on that front by deciding among ourselves that one of the proposed articles, which was bound to reach you if we had not acted as we did, we decided that we were going to remove that from the allegations in any of the articles of impeachment and not refer to it except in the context in which I'm referring to you, that is, reporting to you what happened with that particular issue. We did that in the face of the knowledge that in all our readings, in all our literature, we noted that when President Nixon attempted to use executive privilege, he was soundly criticized, and part of the impeachment process carried his alleged abuse of executive privilege as one of the tenets of that proceeding. And the report shows executive privilege as being ill-used by President Nixon. But here is the point. The managers and I, every member of the Senate, every individual who is with us here today, reveres the office of the presidency. We respect the office of the presidency. The presidency is we. The presidency is America. The presidency is the banner under which we all work and live and strive in this nation. We revere the presidency. Any innuendo or any kind of impulse that anyone has to attribute any kind of motivation on the part of these men of honor who have prepared this case for you today, on any whim on their part other than to do their constitutional duty, should be rebuffed at every conversation, at every meeting, at every writing that will ultimately flow from the proceedings that we have embarked upon. We revere the presidency. And as a matter of fact, when next week we face the prospect of the President of the United States entering the House of Representatives to deliver his State of the Union message, we will greet the President. We will accord him the respect for the office which he holds. He is our president. He occupies the presidency. And we will honor that, as so should we all. But we are capable of, and must, in the face of the solemn duty that we have, compartmentalize in the purest sense. In greeting the president and applauding his entrance into the State of the Union message, as we will accord him that privilege, We do not set aside the impeachment inquiry. We do not set aside the serious charges that are foisted against him at that juncture, because we will resume the consideration of them in due course. But in the meantime, we compartmentalize ourselves as Americans, recognizing that he holds the most powerful, the most respected, and most admired office on the face of the globe. That is part of our duty, as it is our duty to impart our knowledge, our work, our theory, our analysis to the impeachment proceedings which are at hand. These are times that try men's souls, someone said. It was not my mother. And it is true. But anyone who can feel that the final vote that will take place on the part of each individual member of the Senate, that a vote for conviction based on a distaste for Bill Clinton, hatred of Bill Clinton, that kind of vote for conviction should never be recognized or countenanced, and history will condemn any individual who does that. And if a vote at the last moment, at this moment of truth, is based on an admiration of President Clinton, a friendship with President Clinton, a deep tie to and with the president on family and community and national matters, a vote of acquittal should not be based on that. But only the Senate and each individual conscience will determine how that final vote is cast. Oh, we cannot account for the friendship or enmity that might exist with and for President Clinton. All we can do is to do the job that was thrust upon us, that was placed in our hands by a statute that this Congress created, that independent counsel statute. The Congress said that we had to listen to the referral, to accept the referral. The Congress said that we must look towards whatever recommendations might be contained in that. It was the Congress, our Congress, many of you who voted for that statute, which mandated that we consider all of this. We did not simply walk around one day and then seize upon a moment of deep thought and said, let's impeach the president. Let's find something upon which we can base a full 6 months inquiry into the president's actions in front of a court. This was a duty. Much as it is your duty to stay here and listen to what I am saying, the duty that I have of presenting it to you and speaking to you is born of the same statute and of the same process and of the same constitutional background that we all share. So it worries me and us that any awkward motivation can be attributed to any one of us or collectively to us. And once you render your vote, I'm not going to question whether it was done out of blind loyalty or enmity or friendship with the president or enmity with the president. I'm going to judge it as an American citizen, a member of the House of Representatives, a member of Congress, an interested community leader, and last but not least, as a pure American citizen eager to do one's duty. As the moment of truth approaches, there is only one speaker left for us in the Senate chambers here to contemplate, and that is the summation to be given by the esteemed chairman of our committee. And you should know, as we all feel, that the most stringent duty that he ever performed, the gentleman from Illinois, was to manage the managers. But he did that just as well and as profoundly as he has approached every single facet of this case. As he sums up, know for a certainty that he brings to the podium our collective thoughts, our collective emotions, our passions for our work and our duty, and with an eye towards serving you as we serve our constituents, as we serve the Congress, as we serve America. We are 20 minutes closer now to that moment of truth. Keep in mind your own histories, the history of your relationship to your colleagues in the Congress, and above all, the duty to the United States. Mr. Hyde.
You're listening to live coverage of the impeachment trial of President Clinton before the United States Senate from NPR News. Here now, Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Henry Hyde of Illinois. Chairman Hyde is just adjusting the lectern that is set in the well of the Senate. And now getting help from an aide, raising it, and now is ready to speak.
Mr. Chief Justice, counsel for the President, distinguished members of the Senate, 139 years ago, 136 years ago, at a small military cemetery in Pennsylvania, one of Illinois' most illustrious sons asked a haunting question: whether a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal can long endure. America is an experiment never finished. It's a work in progress. And so that question has to be answered by each generation for itself, just as we will have to answer whether this nation can long endure. This controversy began with the fact that the President of the United States took an oath to tell the truth in his testimony before the grand jury, just as he had on two prior occasions sworn a solemn oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution and to faithfully execute the laws of the United States. One of the most memorable aspects of this entire proceeding was the solemn occasion wherein every senator in this chamber took an oath to do impartial justice under the Constitution. But I must say, despite massive and relentless efforts to change the subject, the case before you senators is not about sexual misconduct, infidelity, adultery. Those are private acts and are none of our business. It's not even a question of lying about sex. The matter before this body is a question of lying under oath. This is a public act. The matter before you is a question of the willful, premeditated, deliberate corruption of the nation's system of justice through perjury and obstruction of justice. These are public acts. And when committed by the chief law enforcement officer of the land, the one who appoints every United States district attorney, every federal judge, every member for the Supreme Court, the Attorney General, they do become the concern of Congress. And that's why your judgment, respectfully, should rise above politics, above partisanship, above polling data. This case is a test of whether what the Founding Fathers described as sacred honor still has meaning in our time, 222 years after those two words, sacred honor, were inscribed in our country's birth certificate, our National Charter of Freedom, our Declaration of Independence. Every school child in the United States has an intuitive sense of the sacred honor that is one of the foundation stones of the American House of Freedom. For every day in every classroom in America, our children and grandchildren pledge allegiance to a nation under God. That statement is not a prideful or arrogant claim. It's a statement of humility. All of us as individuals stand under the judgment of God or the transcendent truths by which we hope finally to be judged. So does our country. The presidency is an office of trust. Every public office is a public trust, but the office of the president is a very special public trust. The president is the trustee of the national conscience. No one owns the office of the president, the people do. The president is elected by the people and their representatives in the Electoral College, and in accepting the burdens of that great office, the president, in his inaugural oath, enters into a covenant, a binding agreement of mutual trust and obligation with the American people. Shortly after his election and during his first few months in office, President Clinton spoke with some frequency about a new covenant in America. In this instance, let's take the president at his word that his office is a covenant, a solemn pact of mutual trust and obligation with the American people. Let's take the president seriously when he speaks of covenants, because a covenant is about promise making and promise keeping. For it's because the president has defaulted on the promises he made, it's because he has violated the oaths he has sworn, that he has been impeached. The debate about impeachment during the Constitutional Convention of 1787 makes it clear that the framers regarded impeachment and removal from office on conviction as a remedy for a fundamental betrayal of trust by the president. The framers had invested the presidential office with great powers. They knew that those powers could be and would be abused if any president were to violate in a fundamental way the oath he had sworn to faithfully execute the nation's laws. For if the president did so violate his oath of office, the covenant of trust between himself and the American people would be broken. Today we see something else, that the fundamental trust between America and the world can be broken if a presidential perjurer represents our country in world affairs. If the president calculatedly and repeatedly violates his oath, if the president breaks the covenant of trust he's made with the American people, he can no longer be trusted. And because the executive plays so large a role in representing our country to the world, America can no longer be trusted. It's often said we live in an age of increasing interdependence. If that's true, and the evidence for it is all around us, then the future will require an even stronger bond of trust between the president and the nation, because with increasing interdependence comes an increased necessity of trust. This is one of the basic lessons of life. Parents and children know it. Husbands and wives know it. Teachers and students know it, as do doctors, patients, suppliers, customers, lawyers, clients, clergy, and parishioners. The greater the interdependence, the greater the necessity of trust. The greater the interdependence, the greater the imperative of promise keeping. Trust, not what James Madison called the parchment barriers of laws, is the fundamental bond between the people and their elected representatives, between those who govern and those who are governed. Trust is the mortar that secures the foundations of the American House of Freedom. And the Senate of the United States, sitting in judgment on this impeachment trial, should not ignore or minimize or dismiss the fact that that bond of trust has been broken, because the president has violated both his oaths of office and the oath he took before his grand jury testimony. In recent months, it's often been asked, so what? What is the harm done by this lying under oath, by this perjury? Well, what is an oath? An oath is an asking Almighty God to witness to the truth of what you're saying. Truth-telling is the heart and soul of our justice system. I think the answer would have been clear to those who once pledged their sacred honor to the cause of liberty The answer would have been clear to those who crafted the world's most enduring written constitution. No greater harm can come than breaking the covenant of trust between the president and the people, between the three branches of our government, and between our country and the world. For to break that covenant of trust is to dissolve the mortar that binds the foundation stones of our freedom into a secure and solid edifice. And to break that covenant of trust by violating one's oath is to do grave damage to the rule of law among us. That none of us is above the law is a bedrock principle of democracy. To erode that bedrock is to risk even further injustice. To erode that bedrock is to subscribe to a divine right of kings theory of governance in which those who govern are absolved from adhering to the basic moral standards to which the governed are accountable. We must never tolerate one law for the ruler and another for the ruled. If we do, we break faith with our ancestors from Bunker Hill, Lexington, Concord to Flanders Fields, Normandy, Iwo Jima, Panmunjom, Saigon, and Desert Storm. Let's be clear. The vote you are asked to cast is, in the final analysis, a vote about the rule of law. The rule of law is one of the great achievements of our civilization. For the alternative to the rule of law is the rule of raw power. We here today are the heirs of 3,000 years of history in which humanity slowly and painfully and at great cost evolved a form of politics in which law, not brute force, is the arbiter of our public destinies. We're the heirs of the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law, a moral code for a free people who, having been liberated from bondage, saw in law a means to avoid falling back into the habits of slaves. We're the heirs of Roman law, the first legal system which peoples of different cultures, languages, races, and religions came to live together to form a political community. Oh, we're the heirs of the Magna Carta, by which the free men of England began to break the arbitrary and unchecked power of royal absolutism. We're the heirs of a long tradition of parliamentary development in which the rule of law gradually came to replace royal prerogative as the means for governing a society of free men and free women. Yes, we're the heirs of 1776 and of an epic moment in human affairs when the founders of this republic pledged their lives, their fortunes, and yes, their sacred honor to the defense of the rule of law. Yeah, we're the heirs of a tragic civil war which vindicated the rule of law over the appetites of some for owning others. We're the heirs of the 20th century's great struggles against totalitarianism, in which the rule of law was defended at immense cost against the worst tyrannies in human history. The rule of law is no pious aspiration from a civics textbook. The rule of law is what stands between us and the arbitrary exercise of power by the state. The rule of law is the safeguard of our liberties. The rule of law is what allows us to live our freedom in ways that honor the freedom of others while strengthening the common good. Lying under oath is an abuse of freedom. Obstruction of justice is a degradation of law. There are people in prison for such offenses. What in the world do we say to them about equal justice if we overlook this conduct by the president? Some may say, as many have in recent months, that this is to pitch the matter too high. The president's lie, it is said, was about a trivial matter. It was a lie to spare embarrassment about misconduct on a private occasion. The confusing of what is essentially a private matter and none of our business with lying under oath to a court and a grand jury has been only one of the distractions we've had to deal with. Senators, as men and women with a serious experience of public affairs, we can all imagine a situation in which a president might shade the truth when a great issue of national interest or national security is at stake. We've been all over that terrain. We know the thin ice on which any of us skates when blurring the edges of the truth for what we consider a compelling, demanding public purpose. morally serious men and women can imagine the circumstances at the far edge of the morally permissible when, with the gravest matters of national interest at stake, a president could shade the truth in order to serve the common good. But under oath, for a private pleasure? In doing this, the office of the President of the United States has been debased and the justice system jeopardized. In doing this, he's broken his covenant of trust with the American people. The framers also knew that the office of the president could be gravely damaged if it continued to be unworthily occupied. That's why they devised the process of impeachment by the House and trial by the Senate. It is, in truth, a direct process. If on impeachment the president is convicted, he's removed from office and the office itself suffers no permanent damage. If on impeachment the president is acquitted, the issue is resolved once and for all and the office is similarly protected from permanent damage. But if on impeachment the president is not convicted and removed from office despite the fact that numerous senators are convinced that he has, in the words of one proposed resolution of censure, egregiously failed the test of his oath of office, violated the trust of the American people, and dishonored the office by which they entrusted to him, then the office of the presidency has been deeply and perhaps permanently damaged. And that is a further reason why President Clinton must be convicted of the charges brought before you by the House and removed from office. To fail to do so while conceding that the president has engaged in egregious and dishonorable behavior that has broken the covenant of trust between himself and the American people is to diminish the office of President of the United States in an unprecedented and unacceptable way. Now, senators, permit me a word on my own behalf and on behalf of my colleagues in the House. I want to clarify an important point. None of us comes to this chamber today without a profound sense of our own responsibilities in life and of the many ways in which we have failed to meet those responsibilities to one degree or another. None of us comes to you claiming to be a perfect man or a perfect citizen, just as none of you imagines yourself perfect. All of us, members of the House and Senate, know we come to this difficult task as flawed human beings under judgment. That is the way of this world. Flawed human beings must, according to the rule of law, judge other flawed human beings. But the issue before the Senate of the United States is not the question of its own members' personal moral condition, nor is the issue before the Senate the question of the personal moral condition of the members of the House of Representatives. The issue here is whether the president has violated the rule of law and thereby broken the covenant of trust with the American people. This is a public issue involving the gravest matter of public interest, and it's not affected one way or another by the personal moral condition of any member of either house of Congress or by whatever expressions of personal chagrin the president has managed to express. Senators, we of the House don't come before you today lightly. And if you will permit me, it is a disservice to the House to suggest that it has brought these articles of impeachment before you in a mean-spirited or irresponsible way. That is not true. We have brought these articles of impeachment because we're convinced in conscience that the President of the United States lied under oath, that the president committed perjury on several occasions before a federal grand jury. We have brought these articles of impeachment because we are convinced in conscience that the president willfully obstructed justice and thereby threatened the legal system he swore a solemn oath to protect and defend. These are not trivial matters. These are not partisan matters. These are matters of justice. The justice that each of you has taken a solemn oath to serve in this trial. Some of us have been called Clinton haters. I must tell you, distinguished senators, that this impeachment trial is not for those of us from the House. a question of hating anyone. This is not a question of who we hate. It's a question of what we love. And among the things we love are the rule of law, equal justice before the law, and honor in our public life. All of us are trying as hard as we can to do our duty as we see it, no more and no less. Senators, the trial is being watched around the world. Some of those watching, thinking themselves superior in their cynicism, wonder what it's all about. But others know, political prisoners know, that this is about the rule of law, the great alternative to arbitrary and unchecked state powers. The families of executed dissidents know that this is about the rule of law, the great alternative to the lethal abuse of power by the state. Those yearning for freedom know this is about the rule of law, the hard-won structure by which men and women can live by their God-given dignity and secure their God-given rights in ways that serve the common good. If they know this, can we not know it? If across the river in Arlington Cemetery there are American heroes who died in defense of the rule of law, can we give less than the full measure of our devotion to that great cause? I wish to read you a letter I recently received that expresses my feelings far better than my poor words. Dear Chairman Hyde, my name is William Preston Summers. How are you doing? I am a third grader in room 504 at Chase Elementary School in Chicago. I'm writing this letter because I have something to tell you. I have thought of a punishment for the President of the United States of America. The punishment should be that he should write a 100-word essay by hand. I have to write an essay when I lie. It is bad to lie because it just gets you in more trouble. I hate getting in trouble. It's just like the boy who cried wolf and the wolf ate the boy. It is important to tell the truth. I like to tell the truth because it gets you in less trouble. If you do not tell the truth, people do not believe you. It is important to believe the president because he is an important person. If you cannot believe the president, who can you believe? If you have no one to believe in, then how do you run your life? I do not believe the president tells the truth anymore right now. After he writes the essay and tells the truth, I will believe him again. William Summers. Then there's a P.S. from his dad. Dear Representative Hyde, I made my son William either write you a letter or an essay as a punishment for lying. Part of his defense for his lying was that the president lied. He's still having difficulty understanding why the president can lie and not be punished. Mr. Chief Justice and Senators, on June the 6th, 1994, it was the 50th anniversary of the American landing at Normandy, and I went ashore on Normandy, at Normandy, and walked up to the cemetery area where, as far as the eye could see, there were white crosses, Stars of David, and the British had a bagpipe band scattered among the crucifixes, the crosses, playing Amazing Grace with that piercing, mournful sound that only the bagpipe can make. And if you could keep your eyes dry, you were better than I. But I walked up to one of these crosses marking a grave because I wanted to personalize the experience. I was looking for a name, but there was no name. It said, "Here lies in honored glory a comrade in arms, known but to God." How do we keep faith with that comrade in arms? Well, go to the Vietnam Memorial on the National Mall and press your hands against the 58,000, a few of the 58,000 names carved into that wall, and ask yourself how we can redeem the debt we owe all those who purchased our freedom with their lives. How do we keep faith with them? I think I know. We work to make this country the kind of America they were willing to die for. That's an America where the idea of sacred honor still has the power to stir men's souls. My solitary hope is that 100 years from today, people will look back at what we've done and say, they kept the faith. I'm done.
The chair recognizes the majority leader.
Trent Lott of Mississippi.
Mr. Chief Justice, pursuant to the previous consent agreement, I now ask unanimous consent that the Senate stand in adjournment under that order.
Without objection, it's so ordered. The Senate, under a previous order, stands adjourned until 9:30 a.m. Tuesday, January 19th, at which time it will reconvene in legislative session. Under that same order, the Senate will next convene as a court of impeachment on Tuesday, January 19th at 1 o'clock p.m. The Senate stands adjourned.